If everybody's finished eating for the most part, it looks like I'm going to jump in and just get started. You can work on your surveys. Just like with other presenters, please feel free to ask questions. Myself and Dr. Klimek will answer them to the best of our ability. And I do want to leave time at the end for kind of like open discussion and questions. So there'll be plenty of time at the end also. So first of all, I want to thank everybody for the MDS Foundation for the delicious lunch. That was great. I'm ready for a nap, so hopefully I'll try to be engaging enough to keep everybody awake for the next hour or so. So I'm just going to do a brief review of kind of what was discussed this morning. A good question that a lot of our new patients have is, when do we start treatment? So there are a lot of things we take into consideration when we decide if it's appropriate for you to start treatment for your MDS. Increasing transfusion dependence, progressive or symptomatic cytopenias, which is low blood counts, if you're having gum bleeding, if your platelets are really low, if you're starting to have infections because of your neutropenia, or, you know, you're really suffering with your anemia. Rising blast count is a big one, or if you have high-risk disease, we're a lot more likely to jump into treatment more quickly. But treatment is... we try to be as individualized as possible. We want to work with you, with your family, with what's important to you and your life. And we also look at your performance status, you know, fit versus frail. Are you in good shape for your age? Do you have a lot of comorbidities? Is it going to really, you know, knock you out if we give you a round of chemotherapy? It's something we try to, you know, we don't enter treatment lightly. So we really want to talk to you and your families about what your goals are in your, as we move forward in your life. If you have any comorbidities, your risk category, which Dr. Klimek covered earlier, the lifestyle you like to lead, if, you know, it's more important for you to be able to go golfing, go on trips, and, you know, you would prefer to get supportive care versus coming in and spending a lot of time getting therapy. And personal choice, really, you know, we like to call Dr. Klimek the captain of the ship, but it's you. We're just there to give you navigational support and to give you our best opinion, but really you're the one who's in charge of your treatment decisions. So as Dr. Klimek mentioned, bone marrow transplant is the only cure for MDS, but it's not an option for many of our patients because of their age, because of other illnesses, or there just may not be a suitable donor available. Age alone does not exclude people from active therapies. We have plenty of patients that are well into their 80s and 90s that do fantastic on treatment. So just because we never would look at a number on a piece of paper and say that we wouldn't treat you, we want to look at you and your whole... you as a person, and what we call your performance status, which is we look at your comorbidities, your activity level, your counts, and your support system. The one thing that, you know, patience is a virtue, and all of our therapies take time to work. And the next couple slides I have are going to discuss the time frames that it takes for MDS therapies to start working. Generally, it's 4 to 6 months of continuous treatment before we would say that this treatment is not working for you. And you know what, your counts are going to get worse before they get better. If you're already struggling with anemia, you're already getting transfusions, you're probably going to need more, you're probably going to be more fatigued before they start getting better. So we really want to proactively manage the side effects early on in treatment so that we can, you know what to expect, give you and your family expectations, and kind of plan ahead. So this is the like Lucy Chocolate Factory that Dr. Klimek talked about. This is your bone marrow. As your counts are starting to drop, before you start treatment, all of the good cells are getting crowded out by the cells that's, you know, hyperplastic state. So there's just not enough room for your body to make good working platelets and good working white blood cells and good working red blood cells. So then we start treatment, and the treatment is going to clean out the bone marrow, but you're going to see your counts drop further. This graph over here is of neutrophils. And as you can see, it drops off about 6 weeks into treatment. Your counts are going to get lower than they are before you start treatment, which is why we give you supportive medications like antibiotics, antivirals, and antifungal medications. And you will likely need more blood transfusions. Say you are getting blood transfusions every 2 weeks. They could become weekly. So it is something to kind of plan for and something you should discuss with your physician. But then this is the great part that we start to look forward to. About 4 to 6 months on in, we hope to start seeing a response to treatment. We hope to start seeing when your counts recover, that 21-day mark that Amber talked about, a about 3 weeks after you get your chemo, we hope to start seeing your hemoglobin recover more, your white count recover more, and your platelets recover more. And as time goes on, that's going to help mediate your symptoms of MDS, so you're going to be less anemic on your own without transfusions. And then as time goes on, our goal is to have you need less supportive care, so need less platelet transfusions, need less red blood cell transfusions, maybe even not need, you know, the acyclovir, the valacyclovir, all the medications that we give you that maybe you don't have to take 12 pills a day for us anymore. But the real challenging part and the part that we want as healthcare providers for you to talk to us about is this part here, because you're going to feel worse before you feel better. And I know that it's really challenging sometimes, but we're working towards here when everything looks great. So don't get discouraged. This happens to everybody. A lot of people see their counts drop and they think their disease is getting worse, but that's not the case. It's the therapies we're giving you are going to cause that to happen. So just to review really quickly, it's going to take a minimum of 4 to 6 months before we would tell you your therapies aren't working. We're going to expect your blood counts to get worse before they get better. And to get through the first cycles of therapy, really just, as a nurse, I answer the phones for Dr. Klimek. I would rather that you call me about something than not call me. Like, please, I love talking to you on the phone. That's my whole job. Dr. Klimek, we're all around. We're here for you. Please never hesitate to reach out to either us or your normal physicians. Don't be disappointed if we modify your dose or we delay your treatment because we think that your toxicities are too bad. If your counts are dropping too much, we may decrease you to, 5 days of Vidaza instead of 7. Again, we strive to provide the most individualized care possible, and sometimes that involves decreasing the dose of medication that you're receiving. And this is a graph that kind of shows us, so the purple is our hemoglobin, the yellow is the platelets, and the blue is the white blood cells. This is the beginning of before treatment. First cycle all the way through 4 cycles. This is a patient that's moving toward bone marrow transplant follow-up, I believe. But as you can see, the counts are getting worse through cycles 1 and 2, but then as they start to recover by the end of cycle 4, hemoglobin, platelets, and white blood cells have all kind of gone up to almost a near normal range. And then this is a patient over 10 years of getting Revlimid, charting all of their counts. Your hemoglobin is never going to be what it was before you started treatment. It's very unlikely you'll be 13, 14, 15 again. But typically, patients are asymptomatic when they're around 10 or 11. And that's our goal, is to get you to a livable, workable, new normal. So this is a patient from, 2002 to 2011 on Revlimid, just very... These counts are very stable. We would be very happy with this. So now we get to my favorite part, which is talking about partnering with your care team. My favorite word as a nurse is advocate. I come to work every day thinking about how I can be the best advocate I can be for my patients. But it's important that you advocate for yourself, too. Coming to things like this and becoming informed about your disease, there's nothing better than you can do. So here are some tools and strategies for success. All of this is also outlined in the books that the MDS Foundation gave you earlier today, and we'll discuss at the end. The Building Blocks of Hope is also a mobile app now, which is very great, and all of this information is accessible through there as well. So we're going to talk about how to get the most out of your treatment, about becoming a partner, about our caregivers, and how we can support them while they support us. Asking for help, staying well, and building a plan. So how do you get the most out of your treatment? Like I said, it's important to understand your disease. You should know your risk category, know what your normal blood counts are, and track them. Ask for copies of your lab results. We're always happy to give them to you, and then you can have good perspective of what your disease is doing, hopefully as good a perspective as what your healthcare provider has. It's important to take your medications as prescribed, especially the medications we give you if you're neutropenic. I know that taking acyclovir and you know, taking antibiotics all the time isn't fun. They can have some side effects, but it's really very important. Please keep your appointments and your visits for treatments, even when you're doing well, because the only way we know your disease is changing is by watching your count. Ask your provider about symptoms and that need to be reported immediately, things like fever and bleeding, you know, shortness of breath. Use common sense about calling 911 if you're having chest pain. We can always get you to the hospital if you want to. If you need to go to a local ER, we can always get you to MSK or to your main center. It's most important that you're evaluated by a provider. Keep track of your symptoms. That way you can tell us if things are getting worse or things are getting better, and that's how we know if things are working. Talk to your provider candidly about goals and the expected duration of treatment and what's important to you. And always don't hesitate to reach out about financial assistance programs. Especially the drug companies have a lot of money that they can help out. You know, and sometimes they have stock of drug that you can get drug for free. Amber's an expert with that. I'm lucky enough that I can just send her cases and she makes phone calls, then people get assistance. But there really are an infinite number of resources out there, and we're happy to point you in that direction. So shared decision-making is one of my points of passion. I want to know what you want to do and how you want to treat your illness. We can tell you what, based on your numbers and based on studies, what things look like, but it's important for us to know what is important to you. So how can you have the best office visit with us possible, especially if you're coming into like New York City to see your physician? We want to make sure that you make the most of things. So set an agenda. Sit down with your family members, especially those that are involved in your care, daughters, grandchildren, partners, and ask them what you want to get out of your visit, if they have questions that they want answered. Prioritize, maybe pick a top three things that you want to discuss, just because sometimes conversations can go long and you don't want to miss out on your most important item. By focusing on this agenda, you can make the most of your time. I know it's fun, and I love hearing about everybody's activities and grandchildren and all that stuff, but if you have important questions you need to answer, please interrupt me when I'm chatting about social things and tell me about the questions you have. Preparing questions before the visit, because as much as I'm happy to answer your questions on the phone when you call after a visit, it's best when we have the whole team present and your family present if we can discuss questions together. You know, start with that list. I recommend keeping the list and keeping your list of answers. It's best if you can have a member of your support team present that can take notes during the visit so that you can be engaged with your physician and not worried about writing everything down. Please make sure that your physician has an up-to-date list of your providers. Anything that's changed, if your blood pressure meds are different, if you've had a weird rash, your vision, anything, we want to know all the little details. Keeping a symptom log is very important. The app that we're going to talk about at the end has the ability to track your symptoms, which is really very helpful because it just can be right on your phone. And any test results that you saw your cardiologist and had an echo, make sure you bring that information with you. And then, of course, transfusion records. If you follow with multiple physicians and one is managing your transfusions, we want to make sure that everybody has that information. And make sure that when you leave your visit, you have a clear understanding of the plan. We don't want you leaving more confused than when you came in. I know oftentimes we give you an overwhelming amount of information, but we're always happy to take the spare 3 minutes at the end of the visit to make sure that we're all on the same page moving forward. Know when your follow-up appointments are. Know any instructions for new or existing medications if they've changed. If there are other providers that we want you to see, and then again, things that you should be reporting, like fevers, make sure that you're aware of when to call who and how to get around the office, who you talk to for what problem. Where would we be without our caregivers, right? Our partners in care. Everybody, the whole family is affected by an illness. So we try to, really urge caregivers to take care of themselves, maintain a healthy lifestyle, make sure you're eating, exercising, sleeping as much as you can. If you have a spiritual community, that you remain engaged, that you guys still manage to do things that you find fun and bring you joy in your life. That's the whole point of why we're extending your life with life-extending treatment, is so that you can enjoy it. So I think it's very important to strike a balance. And asking for help, I know it's not always easy to tell people that you have needs, and especially if you're not the ill partner. Sometimes it's hard to say that, you know, I need a break. But there are so many people in your life that want to help. So don't be afraid to ask. This is a great website about building and organizing a support team. It's called Lots of Helping Hands. And I'll show you on the next page, because it has kind of shows you the calendar. So it's a website. One person or several of you can sign in, and it's a free, you coordinate a calendar. It's very quick, but you can organize when a patient needs meals delivered, if they need rides, if they have various appointments, and friends and family members can check in, and they can see what days, maybe on Tuesday the patient needs a ride to chemotherapy, so people can volunteer to help, because everyone's going to always ask, you know, how can I help? What do you need? This is a great way that you don't have to keep track of everything as much, because people can jump in themselves and reach out and volunteer. And it sends email reminders also, so that it reminds they don't forget to drive you to your appointment. What can you do? Yeah, it's amazing how people want to help. It's like in our nature, people that care about you want to reach out, and people often just don't know, and people are nervous to ask, and nervous to ask how things are going, and we have so many digital tools now, I think it's really important to try to take advantage of them. I recommend every day, you know, even on hard days of treatment, to take a moment and think about the things that you love to do, what you can still enjoy, and what you want to work toward enjoying again. There are things that you can do to get to that point, like eating a balanced diet, quitting smoking, limiting your alcohol intake. Try to be active every day, even when it hurts, even when you don't want to. The more active you are, the more you push yourself, the better you'll be able to sustain, tolerate your treatment, and then you'll be able to do more and more. Fatigue feeds fatigue. It's just by sitting on the couch when you feel bad, you're only going to feel worse. But also, get enough rest. All right, and as you move forward with your provider, you'll learn what are symptoms that they need to know about, what are symptoms that I can talk to them about the next visit. But like I said, please always call if it's something new, if it's something weird, you want to know about it. So, as I said, exercise is the single most important way to combat fatigue. Use it or lose it is very, very real. If you don't stay active, you're going to lose it. And it can happen very quickly, too. It can happen, has anyone had, you don't have to raise your hand, but if anyone here has had a prolonged hospital stay, I mean, getting out, even after just a week of being mostly in bed, it can take months to get back to baseline. So we really want you to try to push yourselves as much as you can. Strength training, things with bands or light weights. Physical therapists love to show you ways to work with what you got. It's their favorite thing. They're all like little MacGyvers. They'll come up with ways of, like, you know, they're really fantastic. They've showed me things that I just blow my mind. So you can ask your provider for a physical therapy consult, even if it's someone coming to your home and working with you. If you're more active, a lot of the centers offer group yoga classes. And, you know, so it's not just going to your gym, because gyms do have a lot of germs, and that can be concerning. But, you know, you can come to the center and take classes. Even just going for a walk around the block, especially while this weather's nice, well, not that it's nice today, but while the weather's nice out, or taking the dog for a walk. Other ways to help with your fatigue is try to not eat too close to bed. Don't take the iPad or your iPhone to bed with you, that the blue light. I know, everyone's looking at their people with them. I'm guilty of it too. But blue light is really detrimental which is the light that comes out of electronic devices, is really bad for circadian rhythms. So bring a book. Fall asleep much more quickly. Try to keep your sleeping spaces dark, quiet, comfortable, and do whatever you can to help your body relax. If you're having trouble sleeping, please tell us. We don't know if you don't tell us, and we have lots of recommendations. So, nutrition, stay hydrated. No one here probably drinks enough water. I don't drink enough water. I know that it can be challenging because eight bottles of water a day, eight glasses of water, sounds like you're going to be running to and from the bathroom all the time. Really, it's the best thing that you can do for yourself. Don't drink it too close to bed so that you're waking up in the middle of the night. But especially if you're on treatment, staying hydrated is so very important. Particularly the anti-nausea medications that you sometimes receive with chemotherapy are extremely constipating. And the best way to stay ahead of that is, to stay hydrated and to stay moving. Most physicians' offices, including Sloan Kettering, have great nutritionists that'll sit down and talk to you or on the phone for a half an hour or an hour about your personal nutritional needs and give you a diet plan. There's also a tremendous amount of information available online on, MDS Foundation had some information, cancer centers. Limit or exclude alcohol intake. Make sure you're getting enough calories. Make sure they're good calories, not empty calories. Now is not the time to jump into the newest fad diet of, eating only grapefruit for 21 days or whatever, is on the talk shows this week. But and before you start a supplement, as Amber said, always talk to us about it. And then food restrictions really are based on your counts. If you're very neutropenic, there's a long list of limitations of foods that we want you to avoid. Avoiding infections. Luckily, we're out of flu season, but there have been some pretty gnarly colds and viral things going around. So especially when you're on treatment, we're going to be monitoring your blood counts weekly. If you're not on treatment, that's up to you and your physician how frequently. We want to get a record of what your counts are doing. Try to avoid people who are obviously ill. This includes small children. And if you are around small children, wash your hands often. Wash your hands often anyway. I keep Purell in my purse. I recommend just a little travel bottle. As far as symptoms that need attention, call your doctor if you have even if you just think, oh, it's just a sinus infection, it's just a cold, we want to know about it. We consider a fever 100.4, which is lower than you probably grew up thinking what a fever was, but when you have neutropenia, that's what your fever is now. Avoid taking Tylenol around the clock because you could be having fevers and not even knowing it. The same thing with ibuprofen. Talk to your provider about medications that can inhibit your fevers. Get your flu shot every year. That goes for everybody, not just neutropenic, and make sure people in your family are getting vaccinated as well. The pneumonia vaccine you can talk to your PCP about as well. We do not recommend the shingles vaccine for patients that are immunocompromised, so we'd want you to talk to us before getting any vaccines. Yeah, I believe that's the recommendation because we don't want you coming into the house. If you're immunocompromised, you're often on an antiviral, but that's not, we'd rather you not be exposed to it at all. And I know there's been a lot of questions about platelets today. So once your platelet count is below 50,000, you're at an increased risk of bleeding. Staying ahead of constipation is really important. Oftentimes, I recommend patients adding something like Senecot along with a colace and hydration to make sure that they're not having constipation because that can cause rectal bleeding and tearing, especially when your platelet counts are that low. Don't, be careful about blowing your nose. Don't pick your nose. Use a soft toothbrush. And there are a slew of other recommendations, but those are kind of the biggies that jump to mind. We're going to monitor to your blood counts weekly for the first 8 weeks of treatment, and then clinically, as indicated, we're going to see how your counts are doing, how things are looking, and then make a decision from there. We don't make you come in more often than we need you to. I promise we try to work around your life as best as possible. Avoid aspirin, aspirin-containing medications, and ibuprofen. If you are on a blood thinner because you have a history of, say, atrial fib or a blood clot, that's something to talk about with us as well as your primary care physician as your platelet counts are dropping, because that's something that we'll play around with. Even if you're seeing us every week, please still stay in contact with your primary care provider and any specialists that you have, cardiologists, neurologists, endocrinologists. They're as specialized in their field as we are in oncology, so we really still need them to be a part of your care. And if you come down with something small and viral, you can generally pop into your physician's office instead of, you know, having to go into the emergency room or come on into the city. Oftentimes it's hard to get into your specialist office same day, so it's important to keep that relationship with your primary care provider. And keep us up to date as well as to what providers you're seeing. Make sure we have their contact information so we can send them any notes and lab work. Palliative and supportive care for cancer is something that's close to my heart and Dr. Clement's heart. We work very closely with the palliative care team at Memorial Sloan Kettering. We actually have a nurse practitioner that's implanted in our clinic. When new patients that are newly diagnosed with MDS are coming to our clinic, we're rolling out a program. We call it the 1-2-3 Project. That's about assessing symptoms, including distress, and psychosocial issues every single visit so that we can address issues before they become issues. I know that when a lot of people hear the word palliative care, they think hospice, and that's just so very much not what palliative care is anymore. They are a team whose whole focus is on your well-being, be it physical symptom management, emotional management. They're really just fantastic. I can't speak highly enough of them. And they work with us. It's not two separate teams. We all meet and discuss everybody together. So that's our combined terminology, palliative and supportive care, depending on the institution you're at. They're generally kind of interchangeable. So in the Building Blocks of Hope book, under tab 5, it's the MDS plan. And it's where you can go to help you understand about your diagnosis and help you build your individualized treatment plan. There's several tools that are in there. We recommend that you make extra copies so that if your family members want more copies, or if, as you fill up pages, so you don't need a whole new book. This is very, very exciting. I've only recently started fooling around with it on my phone, and if anybody wants to download it today, we can download it today. Might be opening a can of worms. But the My MDS Manager app is from the MDS Foundation. It's fantastic. There's actually a great little YouTube video on the website that runs through all of, it's like a minute and a half long, runs through all of the things that are on it. But so you create an MDS profile where your score is in, your bone marrow results, your profile. You can enter your labs and track them, track when you get transfusions and treatment. You can list all of your professional and personal contacts. It has a symptom tracker. You can have track your medications, and you can set reminders, so it sends you a reminder to take your medication. You can upload reports directly into the app, and it will sync with your calendar in your phone. There's also the virtual support network, which I have a Gmail account, which is what I use, so I didn't run into that, but I guess it's Google account, so you can save your data and use it on multiple devices. It will group, you can reach out to people with the same risk category or comorbidity score, and it lists available clinical trials, and it's supported by the MDS Foundation, who are fantastic. But this is very exciting, and there's more. It's newly rolled out, and I know that I'm sure that there's going to be more features as time goes on. All right, we're up and running.
So we were talking about, we thought we might have like a download, app download session during the month. So during this time,
See? I should have, oh, see, everybody's ahead of the game. You guys don't need me. So this is just the information about the manager. You go into the App Store on your phone, and MDS Manager, and you can download it right from there. Yeah, this is just the, I'm sorry this slide's so small. This is just a list of all the features I kind of went over, and then a link to the YouTube video, which you can also find. I searched just for MDS Manager on YouTube. It's very easy to find. It's really helpful. I sent it to all the nurses in my practice, and everyone was really excited. Yeah, it's really, and it sounds like there's more in the pipeline, too, that, but these are things that are great because, you know, if we're seeing you every month, you may forget that a week after you saw us, you were feeling so fatigued that you didn't think you were going to be able to get off the couch that day. And then you'd see us and you talk to us and we have a great conversation. But by doing something like tracking your fatigue every day and having a number, and then you can show us, you can bring it and say, this is kind of how I felt over the last month. That is a tool that's such a gift to healthcare providers to be able to see what you were feeling. We can't see it real time, but we can look back with you and then ask you better questions. The MDS Foundation also has a patient outreach and advocacy program. This is the contact information for the patient liaison, Audrey. Oh, yeah. And I think Dr. Klimek has a little bit more to discuss. Yeah, do you want to do some questions next? Pretty much just about everything. So your body is this amazing machine that produces all of these white blood cells that are fighting things constantly. Viruses, fungal infections, bacterial infections, you know, you cut your finger and you don't think twice about it. You may put some Neosporin on it, but when you don't have an immune system to fight it off, those things can become life-threatening. Something as simple as a urinary tract infection, you can end up very, very ill. So we just try to, and there are some infections like fungal lung infections that you would never have if you had a good working immune system, but can be devastating in patients that are immunocompromised. So like I said, any sign or symptom of infection, I'd rather that you call me and me tell you that it's nothing. And I'm probably not going to tell you it's nothing. I'm probably going to make you get a bunch of blood work and get swabbed and get x-rays and come and talk to us. But it's better safe than sorry, because the things can really, especially opportunistic infections, can just really, so very quickly. In a matter of hours or days. So it's, I can't stress how important it is that you let us know when things are going on. Is he napping during the day? Yeah, that's probably our biggest culprit, that I always feel bad taking away people's cat naps. But the biggest culprit for difficulty sleeping at night is napping during the day. Resting is fine, but even a 20-minute, 40-minute nap can totally throw off the circadian rhythm. So trying to wean him off the naps a little bit, making the bedroom dark, you know, light curtains that don't filter light in, you know, try to not bring devices to bed, that kind of thing sometimes. Or there's some great... I use on Spotify has like a sleep setting that's like all like soothing music to help you sleep, and I say it's like better than anything. I'm out like the light, but yeah, or like a white noise machine some people find helpful. But I think that probably if he's taking naps during the day, and it's a vicious cycle, right? Because you're taking naps during the day because you're not sleeping at night. Just kind of got to find that one day to power through and get a good night's sleep to reset that cycle.
So once the chemotherapy, like the Vidaza or the decitabine or the Revlimid or the anemia injections, once they stop working, and the evidence of that is usually a change in the blood counts for the worse. So the anemia is getting worse, the white count's going down, et cetera. We do a complete disease reassessment. Just like when you were diagnosed, we go back in, we do another bone marrow, we see what's going on with the genetics, see what the blast count is, and then we use all that information to say, okay, we need to move in a new direction, we need a new treatment. What does the blood work and the bone marrow and all the genetics tell us about what the next step is? For many people, that next step is a clinical trial. Because if you have low blood counts and increased blast counts, once you've had decitabine or Vidaza, there's no other standard FDA-approved treatments that will work in that situation. So that's you shouldn't be surprised to hear your provider start saying, well, maybe you should go to Dana-Farber, or you should go to somewhere, or I have a clinical trial available here. We should see if you're eligible for that. For some people, that's the sign that it's time to move on to a stem cell transplant, perhaps. Yes, transfusions will work, but transfusions are like a Band-Aid. They're not getting at the root problem inside the bone marrow. They're just trying to give you the cells that your bone marrow is unable to produce. So it's going to have a transient effect. It's not going to fix the underlying problem. But for some people, they can just receive transfusions and no therapy. In between transfusions, they feel reasonably well. They're able to do most of what they want to do. And they can, you can go for a long time just on transfusions. Exactly, exactly. Over time, when the bone marrow function gets worse and worse and worse and worse, it takes more and more transfusions. The transfusions become more frequent, and for platelet transfusions in particular, you can develop antibodies, as they call them, where you don't respond to them anymore or as well. So even long-term transfusions have their limits.
Everybody sleepy after lunch? I think you could, I mean...
I'm gonna have Leah come over here. Could you ask that question again so Leah can ask me? Can they print out what they generate to bring to the doctor? Okay, so there's going to be updates that will increase the utility and improve the functions. Yeah. No, and I think, of course, we want to talk about this app because it's in the MDS Foundation. This is an MDS specific app, but just like the website you were highlighting,
the
Lots of Helping Hands. Like you said, that it's not MDS specific. So there, please use whatever tools you can. If it's just a notebook that you keep. And by the way, I love it when my patients and their families keep a notebook. They bring it to every visit. They have all their information in there, all their notes. And if it's your son coming with you one time and it's your daughter the next time, they just pass the book between them. So all the information is in the same place. If you have questions for the doctor, you write them down. We really encourage people to use whatever, whether it's pen and paper or an app, to just try to keep track of your information. It's a very complicated disease. These are very complicated, difficult treatment plans that you're going through. And whatever systems you can use to help keep things organized and make sure that you're getting the information to the doctor and your nurse, whatever works for you, use it. Use it. So that this is a question that the answer to this question has changed over the years. So, and the best data to answer that question is data that allows us to follow people for many, you know, for years and years and years. So, if you look at older data from like the 2000s, when they were able to follow people for 5 and 10 years after transplant, and you looked at all comers with MDS at centers all around the country, that means different doctors, different ways of doing transplant. And then you just took a snapshot of like how everybody, what the average outcome is. About 40 to 50% of people are cured and they're alive and doing well long term. But a lot has changed in transplant to the point where we're using these reduced intensity transplants, we're doing T cell depletions, we're doing haplo core transplants, and we have better antifungal drugs, other medicines to treat infections and other complications, graft versus host disease. So it's been sort of a dynamic process over the years that's improved transplant outcomes. But what I would emphasize is that in the modern era of doing transplants, we also know that there can be a big difference in outcomes based on your genetics going into the transplant, how fit you are, what kind of donor you have, et cetera. So when you sit down with the transplant doctor and talk about what are my odds of being cured, those numbers may be anywhere from 15 to 20% to 80%, okay? But the best data is this long-term data, but it's kind of like bulk data, and there's a lot of different types of people in that large group, but it's about 40 to 50%. And that's based on something called a CIBMTR. It's a large intergroup transplant group data, it's registry data.
This was shared with me during lunch. An MDS support group and the meeting information. I'm going to leave it up at the front by the bag. So if anybody wants to write down the information, it'll be at RWJ Somerset Steeplechase Cancer Center. And it looks like it'll be meetings the third Wednesday of every month with refreshments, starting September 20th from 7 to 8:30. But I will leave this information at the front so that you can write it down.
And I think Leah said that she, at the beginning of the meeting, she announced that there was a support group starting up in maybe Summit, I think. Mm-hmm. The 19th, yeah. And that actually reminds me that one of the questions that somebody had sent in ahead of time, I don't know if that person is here, is, or it was more of a comment saying that it's useful for them to be around other people who have it to learn and share their experiences. And these support groups are a great way to do it. And I hope I'm not saying something wrong, but at least in the past, I know that there's some folks at the MDS Foundation who are able to sort of help individual to set up a new support group. So if one of you are interested in starting a support group in your area. Oh, it's still correct.
Do you want to say something about that?
Okay, she doesn't want to say anything about it, but it's true.
No, feel free to contact us if you want to start one. Audrey is the Sound Deputy Liaison. She'll help you set one up. You may have a little bit of funding to help start if you're interested.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to go on. I have a few more slides. I wanted to kind of talk about some of the things that are being done in clinical studies, some of new thoughts and discoveries related to some of the genetics in MDS. And I know that, again, some of the questions that got sent in ahead of time were, there was a lot of questions about genetics. So I don't know if you've had some of your questions answered, or if I don't answer them in this next segment, please feel free to ask me. So you've heard me talk a lot about clinical trials. The importance of clinical trials is that we have a limited number of drugs that can treat MDS, and really only one treatment that can cure it. So we have a lot of work to do to find new drugs or new drug combinations to help improve quality of life and prolong survival for people who have MDS. And so the research efforts in the clinical trial setting, again, drug combinations and new drugs, but also I've mentioned some of these new transplant techniques to try to improve the access of transplants for people so that more people can have at least have the opportunity to have a transplant. And also importantly, because of this question that was just raised a few moments ago, we know that MDS can come back after transplant, meaning that there was just some little lingering amount left in the bone marrow that the transplant wasn't able to eradicate, and the disease can grow back. I'm just realizing now I didn't fully answer that question, but after transplant, MDS can be very difficult to treat because the bone marrow is still very suppressed from the transplant treatment. And by virtue of the fact that the MDS cells kind of survived all that chemotherapy and everything that came before it, it can be particularly resistant to treatment. So that's another setting where clinical trials would be a reasonable option. On the other hand, if somebody had a, you know, home run response to decitabine before the transplant and then the disease came back after transplant, it wouldn't be unreasonable to try that drug again just to see if it would work again. So this is a partial list of some of the new therapies. And I say partial, and let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, 10 or 12 new drugs, and this isn't even all of them. So I want you to come away from this knowing that there's a lot of drugs that we're studying, that we're trying to show will work and that are safe in MDS. There is an oral 5-azacitidine drug that's being tested, particularly in people with earlier or low-risk MDS, to try to see if we can try to treat earlier when patients are in a lower, have more low-risk disease, to see if we can improve how people feel and how long people live. There is a new drug that's being studied, and it's looking very promising, called luspatercept. It's a drug that's specifically for to treat anemia. It is one of the ones that I'm putting sort of on your watch list down here. These are the phase 3 studies. These are the drugs that are pretty advanced in terms of our testing, and for you to keep an eye on, because it may be that one of these drugs may be the next drug that's FDA approved for MDS. It seems the study that's going on right now, as some of the people in this room know because they came to talk to me about this, it's not only an anemia-focused drug, but it may have more preferential activity in people who have ringed sideroblast-type MDS. This rigosertib is a drug that's been tested for many, many years, and in a study that was called the ON-TIME study, and I don't remember what the acronym meant. They were testing that drug in people who had decitabine or azacitidine, and the azacitidine and decitabine had no longer worked. That's definitely an area where we need new drugs. And unfortunately, in that study, the survival of people who received that drug was no better than people who didn't receive it. But failure can be a good teacher, right? So they were able to go back and take a closer look at the people in that study, and they think that they've identified a subgroup of people who may be more likely to benefit from that. So rigosertib is now being tested in a study called the ASPIRE study. And so hopefully we'll see if that drug given to people after they've lost their response to azacitidine or decitabine, to see if that drug has a good response rate, and if it prolongs the survival of people after they've been on the decitabine or azacitidine already. This oral 5-azacitidine is also in a phase 3 clinical study. This is in lower risk MDS. So this will be exciting to see if the 5-azacitidine is better than no therapy. So this is, I should say that this study, the Medalist study, and this Quasar study are both comparing these new drugs to placebo. So we'll be able to see if this drug is better than no treatment. The rigosertib, by the way, is patients can be randomized to other treatments. There won't be a placebo arm in that study. A lot of people ask me about immunotherapy. There is a lot of information out on television and the magazines. You see the ads for it for immunotherapy. And we're testing immunotherapy in leukemia and MDS. So far, they haven't worked so well by themselves in MDS, but we're starting to do studies now combining it with Vidaza and with decitabine. So the jury's out a little bit on that so far. There are new drugs targeting things called CD47, CD138, toll-like receptors. These are important proteins in pathways that control cell growth and differentiation in the bone marrow. And so we're learning more and more about why people have MDS, what's gone wrong in the bone marrow. And now we're able to find these targets that we can, and we can create drugs to try to fix that that problem with that particular protein. Selinexor is a brand new drug that is we're actually testing it for the first time at Sloan Kettering in people who have MDS. It's a brand new class of drug that again targets. That tries to fix the way the cells are working so that it can promote normal growth of cells in the bone marrow. Thrombocytopenia is a big problem. We talked about it a little bit earlier. We really don't have good drugs to treat thrombocytopenia specifically. There was one drug, some of you may have heard of it. The commercial name is called N-plate, like an N like a Nancy plate, or romiplostim. Has anybody ever heard of that? So it's a drug that we tested years ago in MDS, but the reason you haven't heard about it was because we had to close all those studies down because there were some people on those studies when they were getting the higher doses and getting regular injections that and their disease turned into leukemia. They weren't sure if the injections were directly responsible for it, but when they did their safety evaluations, they said, you know what, we're not sure. Our first responsibility is safety. Shut down all the studies. So we're not allowed to use that drug in MDS. However, there is a newer drug called eltrombopag or Promacta. Has anybody been on that or heard of that? So this is a drug that's FDA approved for a condition called aplastic anemia. That's one of those bone marrow diseases that was in that complicated Venn diagram that I showed earlier. So this is there are studies ongoing now with eltrombopag or Promacta in MDS, and it's looking very good. About 50% of the people who receive this medication, it's a pill, have improvements in their platelet count. So far, we haven't seen any scary things going on with the blast going up or people developing AML at a rate, you know, that's higher than would be expected. So we've got our fingers crossed on that one, and there are ongoing studies. And this would be major because if you just have a low platelet count or a low platelet count is your dominant problem, we really don't have anything to fill that slot. So we're really hopeful that those studies will continue to show that it's safe and that it works. This is something that's new in the past 1 year. So I was talking to somebody at the break about ways to manage anemia if the Aranesp or the Procrit wasn't working. So we've been talking also about, and you've heard me talk about Revlimid or lenalidomide used by itself. So some data emerged in the past year showing that people who were on Aranesp or Procrit shots, this is the shots that people take for anemia, if it doesn't work, or if it stops working, or if your doctor tells you that your EPO level is too high, does anybody know what I mean by EPO level? So forget about the EPO level part, because that's I don't have a slide to show you, and I think it's best shown with a picture. But if you are on Aranesp or Procrit and it doesn't work or it stops working, what these two studies showed, this study here, and the French did this group, and then there was a United States group that did this, if you add in Revlimid, you can recapture the response you had in the past, or you can respond to the anemia shots like you never did before. So if the Procrit or the Aranesp doesn't work, this is what I would use as the next step. I would add the Revlimid alone, and you can see that with these types of patients, if they go on Revlimid alone versus Revlimid plus continuing the Procrit or the Aranesp, your response rate is 39% compared to 23%. With this study, the response was 25 compared to 10%. So that's something that's relatively new, and it's a little trick that we can use using drugs that are already FDA approved and available without going on a clinical trial. And this is a really terribly busy slide, and I was trying to pull this together. I am so sorry. This is a paper that I wanted to highlight. It came out of our group just a few months ago. Bart Guetta is an amazing doctor that came to visit us from Australia, and he was looking for a project to do over a year's time. And so we put him to work, and what he did was he went back to 2008 to 2015, and he looked at all the patients who had MDS at Sloan Kettering. We looked at the people who were medically, considered to be a candidate for stem cell transplant. And then we went back and just did all of these chart reviews and looked at all the lab studies and the bone marrow studies to see, okay, who went to transplant, who didn't, and why not? Like who didn't? If you were eligible for transplant medically and you didn't go on to transplant, why didn't they go on to transplant? And what we learned was that there seems to be an age bias. What we found is that people over the age of 65 were less likely to be referred to a transplant doctor. And if they were referred, it took longer to get them to see the transplant doctor. As a result, the people who didn't have a transplant, most of them didn't have a transplant because their disease got the better of them and they passed away. So, mind you, this is a study that spanned over a long period of time. And remember I talked about the Medicaid ruling about 5 or so years ago? This also spanned the years that came before that. So, to some extent, it's not the doctor's fault because there are other factors in play here. But we learned an important lesson, and that is that you need to get people to the transplant doctors or at least get them considered, at least determine if they're a transplant candidate early. And then if they are, get them to transplant before their disease gets worse. So in the end, we found that only about 33% of people who we thought were eligible for transplant actually got one. So I think that it's natural to sort of have this concern about age because, we want to provide benefit more than harm, and people worry that we can't do a transplant safely. But again, transplant technology techniques are improving, and so that's the lesson that we learned, and we got it out to the rest of the world about a month or two ago. Genetics, gene mutations. A lot of questions that got mailed in ahead of time were related to gene mutations. This was one of the first papers, and this was in 2011, this was one of the first papers that came out and showed that even when you looked at a relatively small number of genes, about half of the people had a gene mutation in addition to things like cytogenetic abnormalities. We also learned that if you had mutations in certain genes, and I know somebody was we were talking earlier about P53, we know that mutations in P53, EZH2, and these other three genes can be considered poor risk, meaning they change our perception about how you're going to do with your disease, and we can use this information hopefully soon, combined with all of your IPSS scores and your cytogenetics, to help you to understand what's happening to you with your disease. And the exciting part is that it's going to help us find new treatments, okay? So one of the genes that we learned a lot about in this study was a gene called SF3B1, and I know that some of you know about this because you've come up to me or you've asked me questions about this. SF3B1 was, we discovered that that was one of the good ones to have. That was a good prognosis mutation to have. We've also learned about the differences in the mutations between different types of MDS. So this was some data from my group studying therapy-related MDS and leukemia. What we were able to show is that this TP53 mutation that you hear us talking about today and you'll probably read about is much more common in therapy-related MDS compared to MDS that arises in people who never had another cancer therapy. And you can see, like, in the TET2 mutations, this is another gene, is much more common in de novo or MDS. And when I say de novo, I mean MDS that arises in patients who never had prior cancer therapy. So you can see that there are differences emerging between different types of MDS based on their mutation analysis. So what we're trying to do is take these differences, learn as much as we can about these mutations and how they're modulating your disease to try to help communicate to you about what's going to happen with your disease and also to develop new treatments. This is that SF3B1 mutation I was talking about. This was first published also in 2011 by a group in Japan. They did some beautiful work here. And the take-home message for this slide is that these splicing gene mutations, and SF3B1 is one of the splicing gene mutations, you'll hear that word a lot in the years to come, can be seen in anywhere from 50 to 85% of MDS patients. So these splicing mutations are going to turn out to be the most common mutation that we see in MDS. And so stay tuned. We're going to be learning a lot more about these individual gene mutations and how we can capitalize on what we learn about them to develop new treatments. This is a slide that I give to my doctor colleagues, and I don't expect you guys to understand this, but this is what the take-home message for this is that we're learning that as we get older, we acquire mutations in our bone marrow. Remember I talked about earlier about how changes in your bone marrow as we get older, it sort of sets you up to develop these diseases? This is what I'm talking about. This was a paper that was published in part by a collaboration with our colleagues in Canada and also with Sloan Kettering in 2012. And we were able to show that people over the age of 70 have this TET2 mutation. About 15% of people are walking around with this, with normal counts. And now we've discovered multiple other genes that are mutated in otherwise normal adults. And again, so I think this biology, understanding this biology of how we naturally age, explains why this disease is happening in older adults, and it may give us some clues eventually, hopefully, how to prevent it and predict for the development of these diseases. We're also, and so this phenomenon of having a mutation with normal counts, they've come up with a term for it. It's called CHIP. Clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential. What that means is that you have a genetic mutation or a clone. It's there, but it's indeterminate in terms of what it means. We don't really know what it means. So we're now coming up with these formal definitions of what CHIP is, and now we're studying it and following people over long term to figure out what it means. But all this talk about mutations, I just want to make a really important point, and that is that at this point, mutations cannot be used by themselves to establish a diagnosis. And we're working on ways to incorporate mutations into these prognostic scoring systems. So that time is coming when we'll be able to use them for prognosis and for establishing a diagnosis, but we're not there yet. One of the most common reasons that people come to me is because they've had one of these fancy gene panels tested by one of their doctors, and a mutation comes up, and then the doctor doesn't know what it means and what to do. And so they come to me, and we have these long, difficult discussions because now we have a test result, basically an incidental finding with no disease, and we don't know what to do with it. It's tricky. The technology is getting ahead of our knowledge of what to do with it. Another thing that people ask me is, you know, can my genetics, can my mutations tell me whether or not I'm going to respond to chemotherapy? Not yet. But there are papers that show that this TET2 mutation, if you have a certain TET2 mutation, you may be more likely to respond to drugs like decitabine and Vidaza with a difference of between 60 and 43%, but there's no difference in survival. So at this point, whether you have a TET2 mutation or not, we'll use these drugs, and hopefully we'll learn how to use these mutations to predict responses and duration of response in the future. And I thought I had one more slide in here. What I will say is that, remember that SF3B1 mutation I talked about, one of the splicing mutations? Just sort of as a peek into the future, about 2 or 3 months ago, a clinical trial opened up, and it's at multiple centers around the country now, with the first drug that's targeting SF3B1 mutations. Okay, so this is how we do this. We learn about a mutation, we learn about what it's doing to the cells, and then we build drugs to target that mutation, bring it into clinical trials. So again, stay tuned, because more of these drugs will be coming down the pike, and hopefully we'll start having more drugs that are targeting these specific mutations. So yes, the company is H3 Biomedicine. It's H3B8800. And it's a phase one study, so they're just going through the initial dose escalation now. So it's very early, but fingers crossed. So splicing is happening in every cell of your body all the time. It's a normal way for your body to decide on a given day or a given week what your body needs that week. So it's you know how like electricians, they splice, they open up wires and they reattach and hook it into outlets and things like that. It's the same idea. Your DNA is like a template, like a blueprint, but it's modifiable in the sense that you can use a short piece of DNA or a long piece of DNA depending on what protein your body needs at a given time. So splicing, cutting it either short, a DNA either short or a long piece to make a protein, depends on what your body needs. So it's a normal part of your daily body function. But what happens is that if you have a mutation, it's not splicing correctly and it's making the wrong protein at the wrong time, too much or too little of it. What these drugs are going to try to do is just restore your normal DNA splicing program. Is that reasonably clear? It's complicated though. Yeah. We won't know if it's a cure we don't know yet how well they work or how long they'll work. But for example, Kelly showed a slide of somebody who was on Revlimid for 10 years. I have somebody who's been on since 2003. She's on Revlimid and she's doing fine for since then. So even if it doesn't cure you, if it's a pill that you have to take every day, like your thyroid medicine or your heart medicine, maybe a cure isn't what's needed, but it's way too early to know that. It's way too early. CAR T cells. I think you're talking about CAR T cells. Yeah, It's really exciting stuff. It's really exciting stuff. Yeah, and I mean, I just treated, I was just treating somebody with multiple myeloma with CAR T cells the other day. It's so yeah, what they do, and that's not ready for, we're not doing that in MDS. Maybe we will at some point, but we're not doing that in MDS. But yes, so there are CAR T cells, where CAR T cell programs that are used to treat certain types of leukemia, multiple myeloma. CLL is another type of leukemia, low-grade leukemia. And they're genetically modifying the T cells to recognize the cancer cells, so the T cells go in and attack the cancer cells.
On Sloan Kettering's website, if you're interested, there's really, really, really good information. That was like how I learned about it. It was like on our outpacing website. It was like I looked it up. It was very cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's more or less it's more of a neutral one. Yes. I will tell you that when we first saw those TET2, so we knew about TET2 mutations before we discovered them in normal people, and we said, aha, if you have a TET2 mutation and you have essential thrombocythemia or myelofibrosis or MDS, it must be linked to disease. I mean, that's like that was like the natural connection. But then once we found it in normal people with normal counts, that was a real eye-opener, because it told us that some of these mutations are just sort of along for the ride. We call them passenger mutations because they're just there. They're not doing anything. They're not driving the disease. They're sort of passengers. So it really gave us pause in the field that we had to say, well, we have to be more careful about what we say these mutations mean. And so now we're finding that people with normal counts, otherwise healthy, can even have mutations in P53. I could have a mutation in P53 with normal counts. I don't know what it means for me down the road. ASXL1, DNMT3A, SF3B1 mutations. We're finding all these mutations in people with normal counts. It remains to be seen what it means for those individuals as time goes on. We can generally pick those up in bone marrow and blood, but I would not recommend going and asking for that test because we were trying to understand the biology of these mutations in the blood in general and the bone marrow in general. It was part of a research study. And then, of course, when they started finding these mutations, then they really started expanding and looking at more and more people who had normal counts. Mm-hmm. So there, the list of suspects, the types of mutations in MDS have grown, and so first of all, there's a lot of growing literature kind of describing them and talking about them and exploring what they mean and how they contribute to the disease. Maybe rephrase your question. I'm not sure I'm answering your question. Mm-hmm. Oh, got it. Do you know what lab it was done at? most laboratories have really gone to a lot of trouble to include in their reports, and these reports end up being like 20 pages long. I mean, they're really long, where they'll, let's say if you have three or four mutations, they'll describe them, say exactly where they are in the gene, because there's different places in the gene that a mutation can occur, and then they usually provide the information. They'll say, this has been associated with XY diseases, and these are the clinical trials that are currently available to target them. So some of the annotation that come with these reports are really, really good. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know that like Foundation One does really good reports. Genoptics, I think, does. I don't know. Genpath is a lab that does them. I just don't remember their report format. You know, our in-house, we have an in-house panel that we do. We don't send it out, and we do all of our work in-house. Our in-house reports are not as well annotated as Foundation One or like Genoptics, but because they think that I'm qualified to interpret it, so they just. I'm laughing because I just realized that just as you asked me that question, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right, because they assume I know how to interpret it. So. No. But that's what I think, you know, that's what I think is really helpful for individuals and their providers, to be able to say, okay, the field is moving so fast, we're learning, things are changing so fast, we need that information from the specialists who are doing the test to help guide us. And I think that's why I get a lot of consults from people who have these mutations, because a lot of times we're doing this, these tests are being done and we don't know what to do with the information. Yeah. How are we doing? Are you ready for the quiz? Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much. Thank you.